This is the State of Things broadcasting from the Upstage Cabaret at Triad Stage in downtown Greensboro. I'm Frank Stacia, reminding you to keep it real. Tell it like it is. Don't be a phony. Shoot straight from the hip. My next guest tells me that's great advice as long as you realize it's all nonsense. Eric Wilson says we regularly create inauthentic identities, whether on Facebook or through plastic surgery, in front of a radio microphone. We're always making it up as we go along, and we shape and construct our identity. So the idea of finding yourself is a fool's errand. Now, maybe that sounds scary to you, but Wilson argues that we should embrace the ways that we choose to show ourselves. After all, if everything is fake, then everything is real, too, right? Eric Wilson, English professor at Wake Forest University. The new book is called Keep It Fake, and that is what we intend to do for the next 20 minutes with Eric Wilson. Welcome back to the show. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. It's good to be here.
All right, so open up this idea a little bit more for us, keeping it fake and how keeping it real is a fool's errand.
Well, this book partially grew out of my frustration with being told all my life, be yourself. That's what my parents often told me before I would go for an interview or a sporting event. And then when I got to college, I was told I could find myself. But what I found is I'm a very wishy-washy sort of guy. I had a really hard time saying, this is who Wilson is, and I will commit to that identity. My sense was that my identity was constantly changing. It was a process based on changing circumstances. And what I found out was that, of course, that's the case, that our very sense of self is not some stable concept, but a story we tell. So think about this. How many things have happened to you in your lifetime? Billions and billions and billions. But if I said to you, Frank, who are you? You would probably start thinking about various moments in your past that have sort of shaped who you are in the present. So we're constantly constructing narratives just to get a sense of who we are. I'm the person with this past. I'm the person with this present. The thing is we can change those narratives. When you're 20, you remember a certain set of memories. When you're 30, another set. When you're 40, another set. So memory itself is a kind of creative act, trying to piece together a cogent narrative to give our identity meaning at any given time.
Well, William James talks about a concept that he came across but amplifies in his book on psychology, the idea of the specious present. And the point is that we're never living in the present, that our experience is, in a sense, buffered, that it comes in, but we're always really operating off the memory of what just happened a fraction of a second ago and not what's really happening.
Yes, William James says that reality is not found but made. Now, what does this mean? Does this mean that nothing actually happens? No. DNA controls our actions. Our environment shapes who we are. Terrible things happen to us. We can't deny them. But we can choose how we make those events mean. And this is a basic idea of William James's pragmatism. He says, truth happens to certain ideas. There's no idea true once and for all. What ideas are the ones that truth happens to? Those that sort of allow us to negotiate our lives with more grace, with more compassion. I say it this way. Let's imagine life as you being thrown off a cliff into an ocean. Gravity will push you down, nothing you can do about it. But you can choose how to interpret that gravity, as it were. You can scream and flail and do a belly flop, or you can do a nice swan dive. You have that agency to choose how you will make your life mean. And that's where imagination comes in, that life itself can become a kind of art form. When we construct those narratives that we most need, that we most want, to give our lives a kind of openness and a fullness and a capaciousness.
So what you're saying is not sort of give yourself over to the anything goes kind of idea that comes from a constructed reality, but in fact, in a sense, take control of it and understand that this is, I mean, it's very Buddhist of you in some ways. You can have the experience, but you don't have to suffer from it. You can say, this is pain, and understand it for what it is, instead of a large story about, oh, I've got to be on the air tomorrow, my throat is scratchy, how can I possibly be on the air? And then, you know, sort of the big, large story that you construct as reality, but in fact, you're making it up as you go along.
Well, yes. So this is one of the more interesting points of my book, I think. In some ways, it's all fiction, in that when we start making the world meaningful, we're creating interpretations. But some fictions are more factual than others. Some lies are truer than others. What do I mean by that? Well, think in the context of psychotherapy. Soon after my daughter was born, I fell into a very deep depression. I was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and was really feeling awful, as if my biochemistry was controlling who I was. Well, I went to a psychotherapist who said, look, you are making your bipolar condition mean a certain thing that is limiting your possibilities for existing. You're saying, this controls me. Come up with a different narrative. Think about your bipolar disorder in a different way. And I did. And I started thinking, well, yes, it's terrible. It hurts. But also, it's given me gifts. I'm more contemplative because I've suffered with depression. I know how necessary it is for me to be a good father and a good husband to help alleviate some of the pain of my depression. So you can sort of create a narrative that gives you new habits for inhabiting your world. You're imagining the life you want, and ultimately that can lead to a more engaged life with those around you. That's why I can say that some fictions are truer than others, those fictions that give our lives that meaning we desire.
And to deconstruct this, mm-hmm. to show mm-hmm. us how this is really elemental and how we can build up in the way you suggest, you quote a story that Jorge Borges has written, is it Funes the Memorialist?
Yes.
It's an amazing story, and just tell us how that in many ways illustrates the kind of deconstructed view of what you're saying.
Well, yes, this great story by Borges is about a young man, Funes, who has a horse riding accident. And after this accident, he finds that he can never forget anything. And this ultimately drives him crazy because he's just shocked that we can use the same word dog for this creature that is one way at 315 in the sun, another way at 316 in the shadow, and so on and so forth. In other words, he's so particular, the world's not meaningful to him. It's just a constant buzz of overwhelming detail. And ultimately, he goes insane. And one of the points of the story is that we need our mind's ability to abstract from the particulars to the general to provide categories and frameworks that will make the buzz and the hum of life meaningful. Interesting work in neurology recently has shown that our left brain is sort of the meaning-making mechanism of our brain. The right brain is more what takes in the flow of experience. So there's a real way in which the very makeup of our brain treats our lives as a kind of novel. The left brain is sort of our interior novelist that is constantly creating meaning-making structures that allow us to find value in life.
It's interesting to think about the way people have intuited this phenomenon. I come from a long line of nurses, and one of the things they tell me, each of them, my wife, my daughter, and my mother, have all had experiences in hospitals, and one of the things they listen for a patient is which stories they tell as their visitors come and go, which stories they repeat over and over, and that tells my mother, my daughter, and my mother and daughter-in-law what's important to them. They begin, because they know what the pain levels are, they understand the diagnosis, that's all on the chart, that's objectively available to them. What they want to know is, how is this patient receiving, what story are they telling themselves? So they listen to those stories, they get repeated, and of course all that gets ignored, because they've, as you say, a lot has happened to them in that hospital room, and they piece that together and say, this is what my patient is experiencing now.
So it's almost as if the healthcare workers are trying to find what we might loosely call authenticity, right? So in my book, authenticity is not finding one essential self and saying, this is this, I'm going to stay the course. Authenticity is choosing a script you want to follow and committing to that. In other words, acting out the script that you want and knowing you're acting out the script that you want. And to me, this allows for a kind of great freedom and ultimately allows us constantly to sort of make it up as we go along. And that can be scary, but also it's extremely exhilarating. We really are kind of living from minute to minute. Our very next sentence could ruin us, as you suggested earlier. Our very next sentence could elevate us into a wider experience of the world.
What's the difference between that and just flat-out lying, trying to give a false impression?
Well, so lying, as I discuss it in the book, is a deliberate untruth that you use to try to gain power or control in your life. So to me, there is a difference between a lie such as that, me misrepresenting myself to gain something, and this idea that reality is fabricated, right? And again, some narratives are better than others. If I create a narrative that sort of isolates me from other people, that doesn't allow me to connect with other people, that's a bad narrative. It's almost like a bad novel, a bad work of art. So make your life a good novel. That is able to sort of mesh with as many other narratives as possible, that allows you to sort of see yourself as a node in this vast network of narratives. And your goal is to try to find ways to connect with as many as possible.
And of course, you point out in the book the danger in creating too many narratives without being conscious of it, is the way that you suggest, is that then you're sort of having to live one way for this group mm-hmm. because I've got that face group of friends who thinks I'm this, and this group over here thinks I'm that. The torment of having to be that person for each of those mm-hmm. groups without ever consciously understanding what you're doing can also lead to some pretty serious trouble.
Well, yeah, what I talk about in the book is this idea there's a kind of meta position of our mind, right? So now I'm being English professor, author, talking to you. I'll go see my daughter later, and I'll be much different. But I can have this sense of a wide self, a heterogeneous self that encompasses all those different roles, and that way I may not feel that kind of split or that kind of schizophrenia we often feel in moving from role to role.
And, of course, this has, I think, powerful impact just to get your head around some of the ideas that you present in your book. It's called Keep It Fake. Eric Wilson is my guest. He is an English professor at Wake Forest. In the headlines now, the idea of racial identity and the way someone can identify with race, mm-hmm. which perhaps they're not a part of. How complicated is that? We know that race, A, is a socially constructed mm-hmm. idea anyway. Mm-hmm. B, it has profound impact, mm-hmm. so it mm-hmm. is both real and artificially created. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that we can, you know, sort of biologically be a member of a race or not, and then identify with a race that we're not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think that story just shows how slippery the idea of identity is. I mean, there is genetic information that usually labels us sort of one race or another, but once we start making that genetic material means something, at that point, the idea of race is partially constructed, right? So this person, I would say, is in the category of lying in that she created this identity to sort of, you know, allow her a kind of power in life by deceiving others. Surely one could create a narrative that was sort of big enough, you know, for sort of different modes of identity, sort of different race behaviors. So I think, again, the sense is that there are ethical narratives and there are unethical narratives. And the ethical narratives are, to kind of go back to your mention of Buddhism, are the ones that are most compassionate, that allow others their otherness, but also kind of instill in you a sense of empathy. One of my favorite poets, Percy Shelley, said the imagination is key to the moral life because my imagination is precisely what allows me to empathize with an other and therefore avoid stereotyping. And when I can finally empathize with you, I can sort of get a sense of your pain and then hopefully work to alleviate that pain.
You also look at the biology of identity in this book. And, of course, a biological imperative for creating an identity is belonging, is being a member of the group. Mm-hmm. So part of it comes from – you should tell the story about your first word, and maybe that indicates how we get some of our identity. And it's not all from us, right?
Yes. Yeah, so I open the book with I'm the boy whose first word was ball. Right. So my dad was a football coach and told me from the age of 6 on that my first word was ball. I seriously doubt that. That's not a very common first word. Usually it's mama or dada. But it's my dad had a sort of narrative in mind for me. He wanted me to be a football player. In fact, he wanted me to be a quarterback, which I was. So really the first 18 years of my life, I was sort of fitting into my father's narrative. All parents do this. I have narratives that I want my daughter to fit into. So I think one of the goals in life is to acknowledge that, okay, that was my father's narrative, that was my mother's, that was my minister's, that was my teacher's, but then sort of try to write yourself either more deeply into that narrative or out of it. So self-consciousness, deliberateness is very important in this regard.
But this is not a machine. This identity thing that we do, as you say, is part of the brain, right?
Yes.
So it is a biological imperative. We make identity, and we must. Biologically. So the question is, to what extent do we control it? And then there are questions. I mean, we know about people with psychiatric disorders mm-hmm, where mm-hmm. their identity is clearly outside of their control. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, racial identification, was it a deliberate attempt or mm-hmm, is it something that actually mm-hmm, overcame mm-hmm. an individual?
Mm-hmm. Well, there is a mechanistic level of existence, right? I mean, we are biological creatures and we are controlled by the laws of nature. But Our consciousness, I say, is like provides like a little distance from that isness, and that little distance which points us to the oughtness, as it were. So we're constantly negotiating between this is, you can't change it, this is what ought to be, I possibly can change it. So to kind of realize that life is this endless dialogue between the is and the ought, to me, again, it's a risky sort of way of thinking about the world, but it's utterly exhilarating at the same time.
Well, at one moment, and this is the risky moment, it seems mm-hmm. to me, if we take all this seriously, we really have to let go. I mean, you can't have both, right? So you have to first let go of mm-hmm. all of the false mm-hmm. identities and acknowledge that mm-hmm. you've created them, mm-hmm. and then live in this sort of brief no man's land where
yes.
you're without anything, and then come to your more creative understanding of how we yes. build it in an effective way.
So one of my other favorite poets, John Keats, has this idea called negative capability. And he says the greatest poets have this. And it's the ability to sort of rest in ambiguity without grasping for fact too quickly. He said Shakespeare had this in a really big way, because when you read a Shakespeare play, you don't see William Shakespeare. You see a mind inhabiting all these radically different characters. So my sense is this negative capability, it's not a position we can be in forever, but to kind of pull back sometimes and rest in confusion and ambiguity, and note that that can be a kind of space for new ways of thinking, new ways of being. And again, it's a kind of rhythm, right? Sometimes I need conclusiveness. This is who I am. This is what I stand for. But I can't grasp onto that for all time. I need to be willing to sort of step back and be a little playful. So playfulness is a really important part of this book, too. I talk, in fact, a lot about actors that I find especially playful, like Cary Grant and Bill Murray, who, strangely enough, become sort of models for how to live. They play characters who are acting but also seem to know that they're acting.
Well, I had an experience with my grandson recently where we built a fake campfire for him in the backyard with tissue paper coming up out of wood. He sat in front of the campfire. He wanted to have a camp out. He sat in front of the campfire on his little chair with a shish kebab, and he kept turning it and actually looking at the underside of the shish kebab over this tissue paper fire. Next morning, my daughter gets the idea that to keep this thing going, she would take away the fire and put ashes from my grill in the fireplace. He, right, great idea, she thinks, but his imagination, much more powerful than hers, despite the fact that she's a great nurse, he walks over to the fireplace and says, "Why did Mary do that? It wasn't a real fire." That imagination, right? He was that was a fire, but it wasn't a fire. And all of that could be grasped by a 3.5-year-old in a way that none of us can quite figure out still.
That young man's going to be fine.
He's going to be great. Yeah. Well, Shakespeare, too. I mean, we think about the good productions of Hamlet aren't about a brooding guy who is just miserable the whole time. He's clearly working through some of these questions of identity. And the punchline is when he finally realizes that it's not ready action that ends in destruction, as Laertes is wont to do, or suicide, as Ophelia does, as she sort of ambiguously drowns. He says the readiness is all.
That's right.
There is not it. It is being ready for all possibilities.
And that's another way of talking about this idea of negative capability. Just sort of being ready for what comes without having sort of prefabricated notions that will reduce our experiences, right? So try to be open to what comes next without sort of imposing upon it what you think will come next. In fact, I think Hamlet, and one reason it is such an important play in our culture, and I don't think many people have talked about this, is that Hamlet plays almost all the roles, right? Think of how many, he's a courtier, he's a soldier, he's a philosopher, he's a prince, he's a brooding melancholiac. And I think finally at the end of the play, after he witnesses his own death warrant, when he says the readiness is all, he kind of has that sense. I am all these characters, but yet there's a part of me that kind of stands back and moves among them and plays among them. And in fact, that's the only time in the play he really has any peace, is when he realizes that we can ultimately have no peace.
Well, or that there is an ultimate biological imperative, and that is death. Acknowledging that allows all the other possibilities to allow us to be much more playful with it.
Yes.
Did it help you? You talked about being in the depths of depression when you finally came to this. Is it something that can, and if depression is something that you still sort of struggle with off and on? Or
Always. Yeah. And the big moment for me was when I was in this deep depression. My daughter was 2-3 years old. And I remember working with a psychotherapist who said, "You need new narratives." And I remember just saying to myself, "I'm not going to try to be a good parent anymore, like with a big G and a big P. I'm not going to be responsible and authoritative. I'm going to be crazy dad, right? That's who I am. I'm a silly, ridiculous person. I'm good at performing. I'm funny." So my daughter and I would make up these kind of surrealistic games. And it worked. Suddenly we were connecting in ways we had not connected before. This was a role I took on. And I think we do that all the time when we get stuck. We almost unconsciously create new roles. Mm-hmm. How great to do that consciously. And again, ultimately, this is what allowed me, this falsehood allowed me a realer connection with my daughter.
Great stuff for us personally, and I'd love to see it advance into the public policy sphere. Eric Wilson, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us. Eric Wilson is an English professor at Wake Forest University. His new book is called Keep It Fake, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Speaking about explorations of consciousness, a new exhibit at the Weatherspoon Art Museum chronicles one of the best-known modern artists in North Carolina, and we'll hear about the life of Mackie Bain next on The State of Things. Stay with us.